On the Brink is the title of a new memoir by former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. In it, Paulson reflects on the Bush administration's efforts to pull the country back from the precipice of financial ruin, including the unpopular, though some say necessary, bank bailouts by the U.S. government. Paulson led the 2008 federal intervention, and he recently joined Weekend Edition host Scott Simon in our Washington, D.C. studios to talk about his long career.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Scott, it's good to be here.
Remind us, what would have happened, do you think, if government hadn't intervened?
It would have been very bad. If the system had collapsed, many, many Main Street companies, not Wall Street companies, but Main Street companies of all size would have had trouble raising the money to fund themselves, wouldn't have been able to pay their employees, who in turn wouldn't have been able to pay their bills. This would have rippled through the economy. We have today, after everything that's been done, we have a very painful unemployment situation, 10%. The Great Depression, unemployment got to 25%. Mm-hmm. I think if the system had collapsed, we easily could have had unemployment of 25%.
You acknowledge in the book, when you gave your first briefing, I guess, to President Bush when you became Secretary of the Treasury, you warned of some stuff over the horizon but never mentioned housing.
Yeah. I told the president in one of my very first meetings mm-hmm. that I thought it was highly likely that we would have a financial crisis. That's sort of the history of the world. You have them every 6, 8, 10 years. Mm-hmm. And when he asked me about the problems, I talked about these credit derivatives, I talked about hedge funds, I talked about a number of things, never mentioned housing. He said to me, what will cause the crisis if and when it comes? And I said, we don't know now. Whatever lights the spark here will seem obvious after the fact.
I want to go over some of the people who come off well and not so well in your book. That's why a lot of people will pick mm-hmm. it up. Senator, now President Obama, you spoke with him sometimes a few times a day during this period. You were impressed by him.
Yeah, there's no doubt that he was attentive. I'm very grateful for the support I felt from him and got from him in terms of supporting the difficult legislation we needed to get from Congress.
You were impressed by President Bush.
Yes. He was focused. He understood markets. He got the nub of the question very quickly. But we were forced to do things that we found abhorrent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly didn't want to go to Washington to bail out the banks, and I know he didn't. But as he looked at the consequences, he said to me, well, Hank, we may not always look so good here, but we're going to do what it takes to save this economy. And this, and of course, that's what it was always about, was the economy and the American people.
You you liked Tim Geithner, the man now your successor, was then president of the Federal Reserve.
He was, in many ways, as I say in the author's note, this story is a story of three of us, Tim Geithner, Ben Bernanke, and me, and working together. Three people who trusted each other, who had skills that complemented each other, appreciated each other. Tim he'd been an undersecretary at Treasury. He understood government and I thought had a good understanding of markets, a very creative guy.
For the, I'm sure, umpteenth time, let me ask you the moral hazard question. Why does the government wind up preventing Bear Stearns or AIG from failing but not Lehman Brothers? Or, you know, why car companies and not newspapers?
This wasn't a moral hazard company in terms of Lehman Brothers. We worked very hard.
Well, you tried to find a buyer. Barclays Bank.
To find a buyer for Lehman. And one of the worst days I had, that Sunday of that Lehman Brothers weekend, Sunday, September 14th, when we learned that the British regulator wasn't going to approve this deal. Mm-hmm. That we'd largely worked out. We were very hopeful of working out. And I just felt I wasn't asking the moral hazard problem, the question, mm-hmm. Because I knew that this was going to be very painful, not only for all those that worked at Lehman, but for the rest of the financial services industry, but for the American people. Mm-hmm. And I just remember being overcome momentarily with fear and knowing that everyone was looking to me to provide answers, and we were working with an incomplete toolbox. The U.S. government had essentially not updated the authorities and powers that the executive branch had since the Depression. Mm-hmm. And so you had powers and authorities to let if a bank were to fail, to do it in an orderly way and to liquidate it if necessary, but do it in a way in which you protected the rest of the system and the American people. Those powers didn't exist for an investment bank like Lehman Brothers. And so the key to me is to have the authority we didn't have and that we now need and that I was asking for from the day that we had to rescue Bear Stearns. We need the authority, and the Obama administration, Congress, is working on creating that authority so that if necessary, a regulator can step in and has the power to liquidate an institution and let it fail in a manner so that it doesn't hurt the American people.
Cauterize it.
That's right. And then you say, well, when do you use it? Mm-hmm. And how do you use it? And here, I think there's got to be a high bar where you have two-thirds of the board of the Federal Reserve make a declaration, two-thirds of the board of the FDIC, the executive branch, the Secretary of the Treasury. In other words, this should be an emergency authority.
A kind of surprising, maybe not surprising, recurrent theme in your book is you were a tired man. Lack of sleep.
Well, I'm grateful for the fact that I worked hard for 2.5 years and I didn't miss a single day because of exhaustion.
You refused to take anything. You were tempted.
Yeah, there was a time when some friends had given me some sleeping medication. And I didn't, Scott, I didn't want to become dependent on drugs, so I flushed them down the toilet. And as I look back, one thing I know for sure is when you're tired, little problems seem big and big problems seem insurmountable. So when I was active during the day, my head would hit the pillow and Wendy would tell me that I would be...
Wendy, your wife.
But my wife would say I'd be snoring in 5 minutes. So I was always able to go to sleep for a number of hours. But I remember a couple times that were really, really difficult. And one night where I slept almost not at all, this was in mid-November. Mm-hmm. And I was in Santa Barbara. And I had signed up some time, you know, in advance to make this speech at the Reagan Library. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty clear that after everything we'd done and the markets had stabilized for a while, now it looked like Citigroup, the biggest bank in terms of liabilities, was coming unglued, and it looked like it was getting ready to fail. And I remember lying in bed and thinking, after everything we've done, after all this, it may not work. And then I went from there to the Reagan Library, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. Mm. Because Ronald Reagan had been one of my heroes. He, more than anyone else, believed in moral hazard and free markets. And I remember walking into that temple of capitalism and saying, wow, I'm going to be the Treasury Secretary more than any others that's going to be associated with bailouts. And then it hit me that that was going to be the best case. Mm-hmm. The worst case was going to be Citigroup would go down and we'd have a Great Depression.
Let me ask you to contend with this for a second. You write in this book that you think Americans ought to save more. And in fact, it was our relative lack of savings that helped propel the crisis by making us
right.
more dependent on foreign borrowers in Asia
right.
and the Middle East. But to spur the economy now, Americans have to spend more and create jobs.
That's a conundrum. But we as a nation save too little and we borrow too much, both individually and the government. And I believe, I feel so strongly about this point, that if, as a consequence of what we are going through, Americans are saving more and spending less, I think it's a good thing.
Mr. Paulson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Henry Paulson, his new book, On the Brink.
You can hear more of Scott Simon's conversation with Henry Paulson at our website, npr.org. He shares his thoughts on executive compensation and the housing market's effect on the financial crisis. And Scott Simon will be back next week. I'm Audie Cornish. I'm heading back to Capitol Hill. It's been a pleasure waking up with you. And this is Weekend Edition from NPR News, directed by Sarah Beyer Kelly and produced by Ned Wharton, Elaine Heinzman, Kimberly Adams, Gemma Waters, Veronica Miller, Thomas Pierce, Zoe Chase, and Habiba Nosheen. Our technical director is Burke Hahn. Tom Woodward is at the operations desk. Our librarian is Key Maleski, and Melissa Goh is our web producer. Our show was edited by Jeffrey Bennett. The senior editor of Weekend Edition is Jenny Burgle. The senior producer of Weekend Edition is Devar Iran Ardalan. And special thanks this morning to NPR's managing editor, David Sweeney, to NPR's Sean Fox and Bill Craven for helping us get through Blizzard 2010. I'm Audie Cornish.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and we begin this hour with a number, 9.7. On its own, not terribly interesting, but when you consider that the unemployment rate in January fell to 9.7% from 10%, well, that's interesting, and fair to say it's a surprise to most economists. It's a surprise, but not entirely good news. The other headline number in the jobs report confused things a bit. It showed a net loss of jobs, 20,000 of them. To help make sense of things, NPR's John Itzde has this report.
So how can the unemployment rate improve while businesses continue to cut jobs? The big reason is that the two headline numbers in the monthly employment report are produced by two separate surveys. To get the unemployment rate, the government interviews 60,000 households every month. To report the number of payroll jobs gained or lost, the government questions about 400,000 businesses. In January, the survey of business payrolls found a net loss of 20,000 jobs, but interviews with households revealed a gain of 541,000 jobs.
The household survey estimates tend to be more variable.
Tom Nordone, an assistant commissioner at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, says the household survey can experience very big swings, as it did in the January survey released today.
The big increase in employment this month follows a very big drop in employment in December. And that's why people tend to focus on the payroll survey for measuring job change over the month that has a larger sample. And the estimates tend to be less variable on a month-to-month basis.
But, says economist Bill Cheney of John Hancock Financial, the household survey does pick up some things the survey of business payrolls doesn't.
The payroll survey definitely does miss the creation of jobs by small businesses around the turning points in the business cycle, which is exactly where we are now. So there are reasons to think that this may be one of those moments where the household survey is telling us something, even though it's normally not quite so reliable.
Ironically, the normally reliable payroll survey has been erratic lately. November's payroll report was revised to show much stronger job growth than previously thought, but the December revision went the other direction, showing much larger job losses for that month. Despite the January payroll losses, there were some silver linings in today's report that suggest job growth will take off soon, says Bill Cheney. Christina Romer, head of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, agrees there are some encouraging signs in the payroll report.
Manufacturing employment grew for the first time in a long time. Retail trade employment actually grew. Temporary employment that's been going up for several months kept going up. Obviously, others like construction, we're still seeing important losses, but you know, I think on net, we're kind of at this stability point.
But the Obama administration isn't taking any chances. The President was in Lanham, Maryland today pushing his small business job creation proposals. He had this response to the fall in the unemployment rate and the pickup in areas like manufacturing.
Now, these numbers, while positive, are a cause for hope but not celebration, because far too many of our neighbors and friends and family are still out of work.
President unveiled another initiative today aimed at helping small businesses boost hiring. It would let small businesses refinance commercial real estate loans with the Small Business Administration. One revision in today's employment report was very sobering. It put the number of jobs lost during this recession at 8.4 million. That's about a million more than originally estimated. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Snowpocalypse, Snowmageddon, Super Snowball, just some of the words used to describe a winter storm that is upon us here in Washington. The National Weather Service is forecasting 1 to 2 feet of snow for the Mid-Atlantic region. The threat of a monster storm was enough to close schools, offices, even the courts here. Airlines have canceled flights in and out of the region. Grocery stores have been mobbed as people hunker down for the storm, and perhaps for the Super Bowl, too. The flurry of activity has us wondering, what are the economics of a snowstorm? And it turns out there is such a thing as a weather economist, and we're joined by one now, Scott Bernhardt. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert.
And let's start with this run on the stores. We've had word that shelves at some of the local supermarkets are empty. Ski shops in the area have sold out of their cross-country skis. Can a storm provide a kind of a stimulus to a region?
Well, it'll be a pocketed stimulus, if you will. There's certainly a flurry of activity right before a storm, and certainly for snow-related products. Certainly snow throwers, shovels, rock salt, things of that nature are moving off the shelves, as are bread, eggs, bottled water. I'm not quite sure why that one is, but bottled water sells very well. Milk, things of that nature, yes. But that said, it's still pretty much a net negative to a region to have a storm of this magnitude.
I think the bottled water goes because south of New England, a snowstorm brings out the survivalist in lots of people.
I suppose that's true, yes.
And what sort of costs are local governments facing during a snowstorm? We know about salting the roads, for example.
Yes, significant ones. And again, it depends on the region and how hard, but there are significant costs to areas, you know, such as Washington, D.C., Baltimore. They're just not snow cities historically, and they really just don't budget quite enough for this type of storm. I mean, if we look at it back right before Christmas, we had a significant storm in this region as well that probably gobbled up an awful lot of their snow removal budget. And now, unusually, we have yet another monster storm coming into the region that is sure to have a negative impact.
We've heard about a lot of canceled flights. People aren't getting out or getting in. How big a hit are the airlines taking?
A significant one. Again, they, you know, due to the region and the sheer volume of people who live in and travel out of the part of the country that's going to be affected by this storm, it has a significant impact. The airlines have been very aggressive and I think very smart in moving people to different connection cities and moving in advance of the storm rather than having people show up at the airport and sleep in the terminals. They're reaching out to people, and I think have done a great job of it, but they're not going to get to everyone, and there's going to be people still sleeping at the terminal, I'm afraid.
I did see a graph on a NOAA website which suggested there are some benefits of a snowstorm. Those are for tourism and ski areas and also for cold water fishing. The water is good for that, I gather, and also just the water supply.
That's correct, but you know, it's just going to be more Washington, D.C. than it is Minnesota. So it's still going to, you know, be a net negative. I suppose that one of the main positives from the snow happening this weekend is that it's not going to be next weekend, meaning that we're not going to have a snowed out situation for President's Day weekend and all of the economic activity of that, nor is it going to have too much snow for people to celebrate Valentine's Day, which by itself is estimated to be around $14 billion in spend. So, you know, if there can be a silver lining on this particular weekend storm as you're out there shoveling, just be thankful it's not next weekend.
Is there any lore among weather economists of a snowstorm that had a particularly salient economic impact?
Probably there was a major storm in 1996, January 96, that came up through the Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York, all the way into New England and Boston region. That is, that was just a whopper.
Has anyone ventured a dollar cost of that snowstorm?
No, I'm afraid not. I'm afraid not.
I think that's
we estimated the Super Saturday storm, the one that was right before Christmas, at being well over $2 billion. Right, that was significant as well.
just in 2009, you say?
That was in 2009, yes.
Scott Bernhardt, Chief Operating Officer of Planalytics, a company that studies the economic impact of the weather. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Robert.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. What with two wars, rising unemployment, mortgage defaults, terror threats, the federal deficit, and rising health care costs, I think we can all be excused for not worrying enough about Greece and Portugal. But yesterday, when the stock market had its worst day in months, the reason, it seems, was profligate government spending. Not here, but in Greece, also in Portugal and Spain. Those are all countries in the European Union that use the euro as their currency. Their governments are all running big deficits. And it seems that what goes around the periphery of the eurozone comes around to Wall Street. To help explain what's going on, we're joined now by Stacey Marie Ishmael of the Financial Times in London. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And first, is the fear here that Greece or Portugal, whose parliament today rejected an austerity package, might actually default on some government debt?
That is definitely the concern. You could argue that it's a little bit overstated because there is the implicit possibility that the European Union might actually bail out either Greece or Portugal were it to come to that. But there is definitely a fear that all's not well in the eurozone.
How big a problem would it be if the Greeks defaulted and the EU did not come to their aid?
Well, let me put it this way. Greece has 300 billion euro in debt outstanding, as in to foreign creditors, which is a sizable chunk of cash. Greek debt, European debt, is held by other governments. It's held by institutional investors. It's held by various banks across the world. And if there were to actually be a significant sovereign default, you know, that has ramifications for two reasons. People trust governments to pay their debts back. You know, one of the things as a country that you do is issue debt, and people trust that you're going to pay that back. And the second thing is, if they don't pay that back, not only have they breached the trust of the international community, but they're putting financial institutions in, you know, themselves in danger.
Now, these are countries that use the euro, and I'd like you to walk us through, the state of European economic integration in this case. In the U.S., we use dollars everywhere from Florida to Hawaii, but economic policy, for all, comes from Washington. In the eurozone, mm-hmm. the Germans, the Greeks, the Portuguese may all use the euro, but then they all make economic policy independently.
Not exactly. Within the eurozone, there is one central bank, mm-hmm. and the central bank decides interest rates for every member of the eurozone.
So monetary policy is decided centrally.
Monetary policy is exactly the same. But fiscal policy, is slightly different. And that leads to questions of, well, how sustainable is that? Because it's quite difficult to do one when you don't have control of the other.
Well, so far, what's the reading of what's happened in Greece, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, wherever else, as far as the sustainability of the system?
Sustainability, the least optimistic scenario is that it simply doesn't work. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, there were questions over whether Greece would even stay in the eurozone or whether it would pull out just to give itself the kind of fiscal and monetary stability and independence that it would really need to sort out its economic problems. On the other hand, if it were to pull out, you know, and things were to actually continue going badly within the economy itself, then there wouldn't be sort of the big brother European Central Bank to bail it out. So it's sort of a rock and a hard place as far as Greece is concerned.
Well, when the euro weakens, as it has because of something that Portugal or Greece or Spain does or does not do, does that mean that inevitably it will be up to the more solvent and conservative eurozone members, say France, Germany, to assist the others and come to their aid?
That is the logical conclusion of the way that things are structured right now, yes.
And are the Germans, say, enthusiastic about that prospect?
I wouldn't go so far as to call Chancellor Merkel enthusiastic about the prospect of having to bail out one of the less fiscally responsible eurozone members. But there have been sort of competing messages on this. Some countries have seemed to express a willingness to at least pledge support for, you know, if things were to get really bad in Greece, then all right, we'll think about it. Some other countries have been much less forthright or, you know, downright negative, saying, well, no, this was not a problem. They got themselves into this. So the market is really very confused right now over how to read those signals.
Well, Stacey Marie Ishmael of the Financial Times, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.